Integrated Circuits, A Revolution in Electronics by O.W. Memelink of the Twente University of Technology, Enschede, Holland. The following is a slide tape lecture. Is a slide tape lecture taken from a paper presented at the IEEE Eurocon 71 conference held in Lausanne, Switzerland in October of 1971. Summary. This tutorial paper presents a review of integrated circuits, that is, their methods of fabrication and operation. After a historical survey, we shall treat the two types of integrated circuit that nowadays exist, bipolar and MOST integrated circuits. Of both types, we shall consider the fundamental properties underlying their operation, as well as their most important application fields. At the end of the paper, we deal shortly with university training of IC designers. Section 1, Introduction. In 1949, William Shockley published a detailed paper which described the electrical operation of the junction transistor. The paper naturally caused a good deal of excitement in industrial research laboratories, and it was not long before the first junction transistors were fabricated and found to behave as Shockley had predicted. As well as establishing the validity of Shockley's equations, it became apparent that the junction transistor held great promise as an electronic active device. In fact, it had some distinct advantages over the vacuum tube, and, providing that it could be manufactured on an industrial basis, it could thus become a serious economic competitor of the vacuum tube. From 1950 onward, tremendous activity took place all over the world in the research and development of semiconductor materials and their technology. As a result, a series of important inventions in the field popped up in the various industrial research centers, and very soon, germanium established itself as the most appropriate material for the manufacture of practical devices. It could be purified to the extreme, as desired for subsequent impurity doping, as well as made monocrystalline, indispensable for the formation of suitable P and N regions. A very popular method to obtain P and N regions was the alloying process, by which pellets of low melting metal containing donor or acceptor atoms were alloyed to germanium wafers at convenient temperatures of about 500 degrees centigrade. The melting and resolidification of the metal semiconductor alloy provided a well-defined region of monocrystalline doped semiconductor material, gradually tending towards a polycrystalline metal dot. Although it was very successful as a means of device fabrication on the mass scale, the alloying technique lacked the precision required for the manufacture of high-frequency transistors, for which base layer thicknesses of the order of 1 micron were required. In 1955, diffusion of impurities from the gaseous phase into the semiconductor wafer emerged as a new technique for layer doping. As the diffusing atoms, arsenic, antimony, boron, and gallium, did not differ much in size from the tightly packed atoms of the germanium lattice, the diffusion process proceeded very slowly, even at high temperatures. Time and temperature provided convenient tools of adjustment, and shallow doped layers of the kind required for transistors could be reproducibly obtained. Besides germanium as a semiconductor material, silicon got a fair amount of attention, as it could also be obtained in a doped monocrystalline form. Certainly, the alloying and diffusion techniques were more difficult to perform on silicon because of its larger chemical resistance and its higher melting point. Silicon, 1,420 degrees, germanium, 936 degrees centigrade. However, the PN junctions in silicon showed much smaller reverse currents than did germanium ones due to the difference in band gap. Silicon, 1.1 electron volts, germanium, 0.68 electron volts. Consequently, silicon devices had a lead in applications well above room temperature. Around 1955, the tendency was to use silicon for devices like high-voltage diodes and low-frequency power transistors, and to use germanium for low-power transistors with high gain bandwidth products. It was also around this time that at several places, people started to wonder whether successful semiconductor technology could be extended towards the realization of entire circuits. Passive and active components together with interconnections, all on one wafer. It was anticipated that the benefits would be a reduction in cost compared to the discrete circuit, and an increase in circuit reliability. There also seemed to lie a further promise ahead. When the electrical circuit was constrained to operate inside one single piece of material, new circuit properties might, hopefully, evolve. Some technical barriers had, however, to be surmounted before real circuit integration could be effected. Among the conditions which the new technology had to fulfill, the most important were precise definition of the lateral geometry of PNN regions, superior to that provided for by the alloying techniques, electrical isolation between components, flexible deposition of interconnections. The answer was silicon planar technology, which was developed in the period 1958 to 1960. This clever technology comprises the conditions mentioned above and has also the agreeable feature that it is a batch technology, or in other words, it supplies a large number of identical integrated circuits on one silicon wafer. The planar process, which is still the basis of IC production, has been described in varying detail, so that we shall limit ourselves here only to its main features. The key to the planar process lies in the fact that silicon, in the presence of oxygen and at high temperatures, 1000 to 1200 degrees centigrade, steadily oxidizes, thus covering its entire surface with a glass layer which, dependent on temperature and oxidation time, may acquire a thickness between 0.1 and 1 micron. The functioning of silicon oxide layers in the planar process is threefold. First, masking against impurity diffusion. Second, covering and shielding the surface PN junctions. Third, providing an insulating support for metal interconnections. These three properties are illustrated in slide 1, which shows an N-type silicon wafer covered by silicon oxide in which a window has been etched. Acceptor diffusion through the window results in a shallow P-region extending somewhat beyond the oxide window edge so that the surface PN junction is well covered by the insulating oxide. A metal strip evaporated on the structure is isolated from the N-substrate by the oxide and makes contact with the P-region through the window. Essential to the planar technique is the use of a set of photographic masks, which are photographic images of the oxide window patterns, required for the diffusions as well as for the interconnection contact holes and the interconnection metal pattern. These masks, containing arrays of identical microscopic patterns, control the lateral geometry of planar process steps and are therefore very important in shaping the integrated circuit. Usually, planar technology has a standard nature and circuit design becomes, in reality, mask layout design. The mask layout for a typical circuit is drawn at a convenient scale, which may be 200 to 500 times the actual circuit size. This layout is then photographically reduced and repeatedly printed until the multi-element photomask array is obtained. Processing by the planar technology yields circular silicon wafers of 1 or 2 inches diameter with an array of hundreds of identical circuits. It should be stressed that the application of planar technology is not restricted to silicon. However, it is a definite fact that it is most easily applied to silicon due to the favorable properties of the SiO2 system. Since 1960, silicon planar technology has found widespread industrial use in IC manufacture, initially for the production of bipolar ICs, since 1965, also for the production of MOST ICs. We shall discuss these two types of ICs separately in terms of their basic physical properties, fabrication techniques, and present applications. Next, we shall discuss some topics of present-day IC activity, for instance, technology improvements, new circuit concepts, and IC simulation. To conclude this review paper, we shall mention some ideas on the university training of IC designers. Section 2, Review of Bipolar ICs, Subsection 2.1, Principles. The basic component of the bipolar IC is the integrated NPN transistor, of which slide 2 shows a top view and a cross-section. The fabrication of the NPN requires a considerable number of process steps. All other components used in bipolar ICs are derived from the same process steps, and therefore we shall center our discussion around the structure and properties of the NPN. The reader interested in a more detailed treatment of the properties of IC components is referred to the literature. In looking at slide 2, we recognize a P-type substrate, the basic starting wafer material, which supports the NPN structure. A shallow but heavy N diffusion, BN, yields a heavily doped N layer, which will serve to lower the collector series resistance. Subsequently, an N-type silicon layer of about 10 microns thickness is grown on top of the P substrate, thereby burying the heavily doped N layer. As the growing N layer assumes the crystal orientation of the substrate, we speak of epitaxial growth, and the resulting layer is called the epilayer. The epilayer has the important function of accommodating the different components. A deep P diffusion, DP, divides the epilayer in a number of N islands, each one reserved for one or more components. The NPN structure is completed by a shallow P, SP, and an even more shallow N diffusion, SN. An evaporated aluminum interconnection pattern provides electrical contacts to the various regions and completes the structure. Three junctions can be distinguished inside the NPN. The base emitter, BE, the base collector, BC, and the substrate collector, SC. By keeping the SC junction reverse biased, substrate connected to the most negative potential, electrical isolation of the transistor with respect to the substrate is obtained. Depending on the mode of operation, cutoff, normal, inverse, or saturation, the BE and BC junctions are forward or reverse biased. As the normal and saturation mode find wide usage, we shall consider them in more detail. With the BE junction forward biased and the BC junction reverse biased, the transistor operates in the normal mode and as a controlled current source. This manifests itself by the collector current being very little dependent on collector voltage. On the other hand, the collector current depends very much on the BE junction voltage, like I sub C is approximately equal to AE exponential of Q V sub BE over KT. This equation indicates that at room temperature, the collector current increases by a factor of 10 for every increase of V sub BE of 60 millivolts and is furthermore proportional to the BE junction area. For a normal geometry, that is A sub E very approximately 10 to the minus 5 square centimeters, integrated NPN, V sub BE will be about 0.7 volts when IC is in the milliampere range. The DC behavior of the NPN in the normal mode may be described by the simple equivalent circuit shown in slide 3. Physically, the collector current is caused by electrons diffusing from emitter to collector region across the base region. During their transit, the electrons suffer from recombination losses, and accordingly, a small fraction does not reach the collector, but recombines with holes supplied by the base contact. This fraction of the emitter current, which reaches the collector, has been denoted by alpha sub F in slide 3. It is easy to derive the relationship IC over IB equals beta F equals alpha F over 1 minus alpha F. For practical NPNs, beta F may vary between 50 and 500. This property allows the transistor to be used as a current amplifier, as the ratio beta F between collector and base current is fairly independent of current level. In order to give the base current easy access to the active base region under the emitter, or in other words, to reduce the voltage drop over the lateral base resistance, the lateral dimension should be kept small. Consequently, the base contact should lie close to the emitter strip, which should be as narrow as technology permits. As the optimum current density for which the NPN operates satisfactorily lies between 100 and 500 amperes per square centimeter, the length of the emitter strip should be adjusted to the required current level. It should be noted also that the base resistance has been neglected in the equivalent circuit of slide 3, which is an allowable approximation for emitter current densities less than or equal to 200 amperes per square centimeter. For small signal operation and low frequencies, the behavior of the NPN can be well described by the equivalent circuit of slide 4, in which the emitter differential resistance R sub E is given by KT over Q I sub E, very approximately equal to KT over Q I sub C, and alpha F is very close to 1. When the frequency of operation is increased, new effects occur inside the transistor, which necessitate an enlargement of the small signal equivalent circuit of slide 4. These effects can be interpreted as alternating currents arising from, first, the variations in junction space charges associated with variations in junction voltages, and second, the variation in base injection charge consisting of electrons supplied by the emitter and holes supplied by the base contact. Under small signal conditions, these effects assume a purely capacitive nature and can be represented by capacitances in equivalent circuit, as shown in slide 5, where C sub BE, C sub BC, and C sub SC denote junction space charge capacitances, and C sub INJ the base injection or diffusion capacitance. In addition to the normal mode, a second mode of operation, which is also often used, of the integrated NPN is the saturation mode. In this condition, the BE as well as the BC junctions are both forward biased, and the transistor carries a very small collector emitter voltage of about 0.1 volt. This mode finds wide usage in switching circuits such as digital ICs. The saturation mode demands more base current than is used in the normal mode because two junctions are forward biased. Hole injection from the base into the lightly doped collector may give rise to a considerable injection charge in the collector region, leading to delaying effects in the turn-off behavior of the transistor switch. Also, a hole current may flow towards the substrate due to parasitic action of the PNP constituted by the base layer, epilayer, and substrate. Such spurious substrate currents may cause unwanted biasing effects in ICs. The function of the buried layer comes to full deployment in the saturation mode. It reduces the collector series resistance and keeps the collector emitter voltage low. The NPN is the principal active element in all linear and digital ICs. Usually it is supplemented by two other components, the diffuse resistor and the lateral PNP transistor. A resistor in IC realization makes use of the lateral resistive properties of the N or P layers, like an SP or SN diffusion, or the epilayer itself. The square resistance of these layers, that is, the resistance of a slab of equal length and width, is about 200 ohms for SP, 5 ohms for SN, or 1000 ohms EPI. With these three possibilities and appropriate adjustment of geometry, resistors with values between 10 and 10 to the 4th ohms can be made. Values in excess of 10 to the 4th ohms are feasible, but suffer from increased inaccuracy of resistor value. A resistor structure is shown in slide 6. The lateral PNP is the best we can do in realizing a PNP without extra technology steps. One may question why the vertical transistor is an NPN rather than a PNP. The answer is that the vertical PNP is more difficult to make in terms of doping concentrations and surface stability. As can be seen from slide 7, the lateral PNP has an emitter and a collector region formed by a simultaneous SP diffusion. The collector surrounds the emitter in order to collect as many emitted holes as possible. Also, the buried PN layer is incorporated to prevent PNP action towards the substrate. Despite these precautions, the current multiplication factor, beta sub f, of the PNP is rather poor, between 5 and 20, mainly because the relatively large distance between emitter and collector, 5 to 10 microns, dictated by the minimum dimensions attainable between two diffused regions. The DC properties of the lateral PNP can be approximated by an equivalent circuit, analogous to slide 3, provided that the collector current remains in the lower milliampere range. Reviewing the properties of bipolar IC components, we see that they are based on PN junction effects and lateral layer resistivities. In the vertical sense, perpendicular to the crystal surface, the IC structure is composed by processes like epitaxy, diffusion, and oxidation, which have usually a standard outline. In the lateral sense, parallel to the crystal surface, the IC designer has the freedom to adjust dimensions to obtain the desired quantitative performance of each component, an activity known as mask design. The NPN, PNP, and resistor are the most frequently used bipolar IC components. PN junction capacitance or oxide capacitance may be used to simulate capacitors, but this has limited value because of the crystal surface area available, the attainable capacitor values being quite low, less than or equal to 10 picofarads. In a few cases, a junction field effect transistor, or even an insulated gate field effect transistor, is incorporated in a bipolar IC, with the purpose of achieving special electrical characteristics. This has, however, always to be paid for by an increase in technological complexity. Subsection 2.2. Applications. There exist two distinct fields of application of bipolar ICs of large technical importance. Linear and digital circuits, which we shall consider separately. Among the linear bipolar ICs, we count the very popular operational amplifier, instrumentation circuitry, voltage regulators, audio amplifiers, radio and complex TV circuitry, communication equipment, etc., etc. The frequency range stretches from DC to tens of megacycles, and the power dissipation per IC is usually low, less than 100 milliwatts. Voltages and currents in linear ICs tend to cover a continuous range of values with the requirement that they exhibit a linear interrelationship. Usually this is achieved by applying internal feedback unless the voltage signals occurring in the circuit are already small enough, less than 10 millivolts, to consider the transistors as linear devices. A definite constraint in linear ICs is the poor reproducibility of IC technology at the wafer level. For instance, layer resistivities and junction areas may differ from wafer to wafer on account of variations in process parameters. Within a wafer, or on an even smaller scale, within an IC die, the harmony in circuit parameters may, however, be much better. An elegant way to avoid the influence of such variations in IC parameters is to make the circuit properties depend on parameter ratios rather than absolute values. There is a tendency to use as few resistors in linear ICs as possible, as against active devices like NPN or PNP. The reason for this is that resistors generally require more crystal area than transistors. This tendency, stimulated by the good reproducibility of different transistors within one IC, has led to the development of a number of interesting circuit arrangements. An outline of the arrangements, basic circuits as we may call them, has been given by Kamenzind and Grabin, to which the interested reader is referred. Among the basic circuits we count bias voltage supplies, current sources, DC level shifters, small signal current and voltage amplifiers. A good illustration of the use of such basic circuits is the operational amplifier described by Harden and Hellstrom, which has been redrawn in slide 8. This op-amp has an open-loop voltage gain of 85 dB, or about 15,000, a bandwidth of 400 Hz, a common mode rejection ratio of 70 dB, all at a power consumption of 300 microwatts or less. In the circuit, transistor Q9 serves as a voltage source which biases Q3 and Q8. The external resistor, R sub CS, adjusts the current through Q9 and thereby the bias of the complete op-amp as well as its voltage gain. As Q3, Q8 and Q9 share the same base emitter voltage, their collector current will be proportional to their respective emitter areas. We thus see that R sub CS, Q3 and Q9 serve as a current source to the differential input pair Q1, Q2. The PNP pair Q4, Q4 prime also operates as a current source, controlled by the collector current of Q1 and supplying an equal current to the collector of Q2. For zero input voltage, the collector currents of Q1 and Q2 will be equal to the base current of Q5 prime, hence be zero. In the presence of an input signal, the pair Q4, Q4 prime serves to add the collect current signals of Q1 and Q2, both signals entering the base of Q5 prime. Transistors Q5 prime and Q5 function as current amplifying stages between the differential pair Q1, Q2 and the output transistor Q6. The output stage consists of a PNP-NPN push-pull arrangement. As the lateral PNP Q7 has a poor current gain and an inferior current carrying capability, the current of Q7 is amplified by NPN Q7 prime. The proper bias of the output transistors Q6 and Q7 is obtained from diodes D1, D2 and transistor Q8. In AC operation, D1 and D2 act as a DC voltage level shifting network with small internal impedance, supplying signal voltage to the NPN as well as to the PNP transistor. The small emitter resistors of Q6 and Q7 are the only resistors in the circuit and merely serve as a short circuit protection. The dazzling activity around the world in the development of information processing systems has to a large extent been made possible by the existence of digital ICs. The majority of these ICs are bipolar digital ICs, and a minority consists of MOST ICs, to which we shall come back in the next section. The success of the digital IC lies in the fact that, compared to a circuit consisting of discrete components, its cost is much lower and its reliability much higher. They perform logic functions, of which the most simple are the AND, OR, exclusive OR, and NOT functions, with logic variables which may have two values, 1 and 0. Beside these simple functions, more complex functions exist in IC form, with up to hundreds of transistors per die, like coders, decoders, counters, and memories. Despite the large number of circuits available, there is a limited number of circuit families, each family being characterized by its basic gate circuit. An extensive survey of these logic families has been given by Garrett, to which reference should be made for further reading. Here we shall only touch on the principal properties of bipolar digital ICs. In all basic gate circuits, the result of a logic operation appears as a voltage across a resistor, caused by a two-valued current, which is a logic function of the input voltages. The resistor voltage may in turn be used as the input voltage for a subsequent logic gate. The difference between the various families of digital ICs lies in the way that the two-valuedness of the resistor current comes about, and how the logic operation between the input voltages resulting in the resistor current is brought about. In saturated logic ICs, the resistor is in series with a transistor, which is either non-conducting or operating in the saturation mode. The two logic states are therefore well determined and do not depend on transistor properties. The most successful family of saturated logic ICs is TTL, transistor-transistor logic. Compared to the other saturated logic families like RTL, resistor-transistor logic, and DTL, diode-transistor logic, it features the smallest propagation delay time per gate, about 10 nanoseconds, and the largest driving capability for subsequent stages, fan-out. For these reasons, TTL has grown into the largest family of logic ICs in terms of available functions. To illustrate some essential properties of TTL, we have drawn in slide 9 a three-input NAND gate, and we shall briefly discuss its operation. Transistor Q2 behaves as a saturating switch. When all inputs are high, the three-emitter transistor Q1 is off. That is to say, the BC diode of Q1 will still be forward biased and will therefore pass a current from V sub CC via R1 into the base of Q2. This base current is sufficient to bring Q2 into saturation, which results in the entire voltage supply in the entire supply voltage V sub CC appearing across R2 and R4 together. If one or more of the inputs is low, the associated emitters of Q1 will be forward biased and, by NPN action of Q1, current will be pulled from the base of Q2 towards the low input. Hence Q2 turns off, resulting in a zero potential drop across R2 and R4. We see that Q1 performs a logic AND function upon the input voltages, whereas Q2, together with R2 and R4, acts as an inverter. One of the attractions of transistor Q1 is that when Q2 turns off, Q1 quickly removes excess injection charge from Q2, which had been accumulated during the saturation interval. Transistors Q3 and Q4 do not add to the logic operation, they only enhance the fan-out of the gate. When Q4 is off, Q3 will be on and vice versa, thus providing either a source or a sink of current for subsequent gates. Another family of bipolar digital ICs, which should be mentioned, is very much alone from the point of view of operation. This family is called ECL, emitter-coupled logic, and the basic gate exhibits a two-valued current caused by an alternating current distribution between the two transistors of a differential pair. In slide 10 is shown a 3-input ECL gate, which at its two outputs delivers the OR and the NOR function of the inputs. When the inputs are low, all transistors Q1 are non-conducting and the voltage drop across R1 will be zero. A current, the magnitude of which is set by the base bias voltage of Q2 and R3, flows via R2, Q2 and R3. The value of R2 has been carefully chosen so as to keep the BC junction of Q2 just outside the forward conduction. If one or more of the inputs is high, the current of the differential pair will be diverted from Q2 to Q1, and a voltage drop develops over R1 as it vanishes over R2. The emitter followers, Q3, R4, and Q4, R5, enhance the fan-out and also match the DC levels of the output to the input. Because of the operation outside saturation and the small voltage amplitudes employed, ECL is the fastest logic family available. Propagation delay per gate, about 1 nanosecond. On the other hand, the small voltage amplitudes required to operate an ECL gate make it quite sensitive to spurious signals. Section 3, Review of MOST ICs. Subsection 3.1, Principles. Where one might argue that the bipolar IC still shows some affinity with the discrete approach, as the separate components are still distinguishable, the MOST IC seems to be a circuit realization in which the difference between components and interconnections becomes more diffuse. The basic element of an MOST IC is the MOS transistor, of which slide 11 shows an illustration. Two shallow P-type regions border a region consisting of a metal, called a gate, covering the oxide, and silicon between the two P-regions. When a negative potential is applied to the gate, sufficient to make the oxide feel between 10 to the 5th and 10 to the 6th volts per centimeter, a shallow positive surface charge will result, under the oxide, by charge induction. Part of this charge will be depletion charge due to ionized donors, as electrons have been pushed away from the surface. The remainder of the charge will consist of holes supplied by the two P-regions. The importance of the MOST as a circuit element lies in the fact that the hole charge forms a conductive path controlled by the gate to bulk voltage between the two P-regions. The above-noted oxide fields necessary to induce conduction amount to reasonable gate voltages, 2 to 20 volts, provided that the gate oxide is thin, 0.1 to 0.2 microns. It is quite helpful to the understanding of the MOST, which has been explained in more detail in the literature, to consider the gate voltage-dependent hole charge, or P-channel, as a field-induced P-region, making contact with two diffused P-regions. To avoid substrate currents, all P-regions, induced or diffused, should remain reverse-biased with respect to the substrate, a situation which is easily established by connecting the substrate to the most positive potential. Taking a slightly more quantitative look at the MOST, we ascertain that the surface charge per square centimeter should be equal to Q sub Si equals C sub Aux modulus of Vg minus Vd, where C sub Aux is the oxide capacitance, about 2 times 10 to the minus 8 farads per square centimeter, and the modulus Vg minus Vd, the voltage across the oxide, with Vg being the gate voltage and Vd being the voltage of both P regions. Unfortunately, not all surface charge Q sub Si will be mobile hole charge. As we already mentioned, part of Q sub Si is depletion charge, which increases when the surface potential Vd increases. Furthermore, some surface charge will be positive oxide charge caused by positive ions grown into the oxide during MOST fabrication. To account for these effects, a term V sub T is added to the equation just mentioned to transform it into an expression for the hole charge Q sub H. Q sub H equals C sub Aux modulus of Vg minus Vd minus Vt. The gate voltage V sub G, for which Q sub H is just zero, is called the gate threshold voltage. In slide 12, we have drawn V sub G th versus V D curves for two MOST structures. The usefulness of V sub G th versus V D curves, which can be directly measured, lies in the fact that one can immediately establish the conditions for the existence or the absence of a channel. If minus VG is larger than minus V sub G th for a certain minus VD value, there will be MOST conduction. And if minus VG is smaller than minus V sub G th, the electric connection between the two P regions will be disrupted. Endowed with the properties so far mentioned, it is clear that the MOST should be able to function as a most interesting tiny electronic switch. Unlike the bipolar transistor, its switching behavior will be symmetrical, and the DC control current virtually zero. Also, experience has shown that with the usual length of channel, 5 to 10 microns, the response of channel formation upon gate voltage changes happens within a few nanoseconds. When we add to this that MOST IC fabrication requires considerably less planar process steps than bipolar IC fabrication, and that the MOST is in general smaller than the bipolar transistor, we understand why nowadays the application of MOSTs in ICs is gaining rapidly in importance. Subsection 3.2. Applications. To realize an MOST IC may seem to be just a matter of combining structures like slide 11 inside one silicon die. There is, however, a difficulty which arises. Some interconnections, like those connected to gates or power supply lines, carry negative voltages which should be sufficient to induce channel conduction where MOSTs are supposed to be located. However, at all other places where these interconnections run over the oxide, channel formation should be inhibited, as it may cause undesired leakage paths which may seriously affect the DC bias of the circuit. A way to achieve this is to enhance the substrate donor concentration outside the active gate regions by a modest donor diffusion of about 10 to the 17th per cubic centimeter donor atoms near the surface. An extra step, which costs little technological effort but which reduces the wiring capacitance, is to thicken the oxide outside the active gate regions. Slide 12 shows the gate threshold voltage V sub G th as a function of surface potential V sub D for an active and parasitic MOST structure inside one die obtained by such technological measures. The main field of application of the MOST is the logic circuit field, for which it is extremely well suited, being, as we have seen, an almost perfect switch. Logic MOST ICs may be divided into combinatorial and sequential circuits. In combinatorial circuits, there exists a unique relationship between input and output variables, independent of earlier conditions, and hence they perform instant logic operations. In sequential circuits, the output variables depend on momentary as well as earlier values of input variables, hence they memorize an input situation. A typical combinatorial circuit consists of parallel and series combinations of MOST switches, which control a current through an MOST load. The load voltage, in turn, may be used to control subsequent MOST switches. An MOST load is very much comparable to a resistor, and obtained by connecting the gate of the MOST to the most negative terminal. As a consequence, the MOST will exhibit a non-linear resistive behavior, provided that the voltage across it exceeds a value V sub T, as shown on slide 12. Slide 13 shows an example of a combinatorial circuit. It is a simple three-input NAND circuit with three active MOSTs, A, and one load MOST, L. When all inputs are about 0 volts, the A MOSTs will be off, as the gate voltages are below threshold. Hence the output, being connected via the L MOST to the V sub DD voltage supply, will be 1. When the inputs are 1, or the gate voltage on all inputs exceeds the threshold voltage, all MOSTs will be on, and a direct current passes from V sub DD to ground. Provided that the resistance offered by the three A MOSTs is small compared to the resistance of the L MOST, which can be realized by adjustment of gate geometries, the output will be zero. Hence, a typical NAND operation is present. A second, although slightly more complicated combinatorial circuit is shown in slide 14, which is an exclusive OR circuit. This circuit contains 5A and 4L MOSTs. A combinatorial circuit of growing importance, working also with L and A MOSTs, is the ROM, read-only memory. Dependent on the binary input address, it delivers certain binary numbers at its output terminals. The attraction of the ROM is that it can be easily programmed. The MOSTs of the circuit are neatly arranged in a rectangular array of crossing address lines. Programming the ROM is a simple matter of depositing active gate regions on the array nodes involving the change of the layout of one mask only. ROMs are in favor for binary code conversion, lookup tables, character generators, and so on. As the individual MOSTs may be made very small, about 20 by 40 square microns, and die sizes of a few square millimeters may be produced with good yields, ROMs for more than 1,000 bits are not uncommon. With a growth in circuit performance, the IC manufacturer dreads an increase in the number of pins of the IC package. Normally, the IC package takes more than half the entire IC cost, and the more pins are required, the more expensive the package becomes. What we see in practice is that even for the large-size MOST ICs, LSI, large-scale integration, the number of package pins remains in the order of 20 to 30. This is achieved by using, on the die, extra input and output circuitry beside the main circuit, which organize the binary signals for internal operation. Coming now to the sequential MOST ICs, we count among them circuits which memorize or retain electrical information. A very simple 1-bit memory cell is the MOST flip-flop off slide 15, which consists of two cross-coupled inverters and write-read circuitry. Such memory cells are also arranged into a rectangular array on the silicon die, with the write-read inputs connected to horizontal lines, 2 per row, and the outputs connected to vertical, bit lines, 1 per column. In this fashion, a so-called RAM, random access memory, is obtained, and we shall briefly consider its operation. Assume that all cells contain Q equals 0. Information is written into a row of memory cells by applying a negative voltage, approximately V sub dd, to the write select line, which brings all the M1 MOSTs of that row into conduction and which connects the flip-flops to their associated bit lines. If the bit line carries a 0, Q tends to 0, and if the bit line carries a 1, Q tends to 1. To read the content of a particular cell, its read select line is brought to a negative voltage and M3 becomes conducting. With Q equals 0, M2 will be off and the bit line will carry a 1. If Q equals 1, M2 will be on and the bit line carries a 0. Hence, the information read is the inverse of the information written in. MOS, RAMs, are gaining rapidly in popularity and seem to become serious competitors of the smaller types of magnetic core memories. The type of cell employed in an RAM need not be the flip-flop of slide 15. A great many investigations are presently going on to design new cells, which always means finding a compromise between RAM size and cost, power consumption, electrical stability, and speed of access. An example of a cell of smaller size with much lower power dissipation than the cell of slide 15 is shown in slide 16. The information is retained as a charge on the gate bulk capacitance of MOST M2. It is easy to notice that the cell is very similar to the write-read circuit of slide 15, where also the charge condition of the M2 gate determines the logic state of the cell. In slide 15, however, the state is maintained indefinitely by the flip-flop, and therefore the cell features static operation. In slide 16, the logic state may have the tendency to disappear because of leakage from the M2 gate to earth, and therefore the charge should be periodically replenished from the write data line. Consequently, the memory cell is said to be of the dynamic type. Typical of a static circuit, such as slide 15, is the possibility of direct current flow from V sub dd to Earth. In a dynamic circuit, like slide 16, there never exists a DC current, only, at most, capacitive currents. This explains the difference in dissipation between static and dynamic circuits.